Welcome to Wisdom Personified, Conversations with Dudumsomi, a passionate and relentless pursuit of exploring how individuals use good judgment in everyday life, both in their personal and professional lives. Terry Oakley-Smith aptly puts it, being a pioneer means forging ahead, not knowing exactly where you're going, but having faith in the journey. Today's insightful episode features Terry, a pioneer in diversity and change management in South Africa. She is a psychologist and former academic who has successfully carved a path and dedicated herself to fostering transformation, diversity, equity, and inclusion in South Africa. She founded Diversity in 1993, specializing in transformation and diversity training, with degrees from the University of Wales and the University of Witwatersrand. Terry blends academic rigor with practical expertise. Her research, dialogues, and leadership on governmental commissions aims to foster mutual respect and productivity across diverse workplaces, transcending racial, gender, and cultural divides. Terry, thank you so much for making the time.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's overdue. Really overdue, but thank you so much. So, where were you born? Do you have siblings?
I have and had. I was born in Liverpool.
Oh.
And I support the team.
Still.
Yes. I had an identical twin.
Oh, wow.
Who sadly now has passed, and another sister and two brothers. And actually, I think having an identical twin was what set me off on being so interested in difference.
Mm.
Because I sort of grew up hearing people asking me, how do you tell the difference? And which is which?
Yeah.
And so I think unconsciously, obviously, that made me interested in the differences between people.
Mm. Hmm. Okay. There's something about a twin in my life that I'm thinking about. Ah. Okay. What was a felt squirrel? And what was taught in these environments?
The felt schools were prominent during the apartheid era, basically. And what they were passed off as was sort of holiday camps for white children, to go and experience the bush, etc. But the syllabuses of them really were about helping white children to understand apartheid, to understand how evil communism was, to understand how different and unpleasant black people were, and how we were so very much superior. And a lot was written about felt schools back in the 80s and 90s, but of course, there's no such thing now.
Hmm.
But I think a lot of white people who would be in their 60s or 70s would have experienced felt school.
Wow. I mean, until I was doing research on you, I didn't know about the concept.
Mm.
Amazing how much of our history we don't know.
I know. It's, I suppose, like Russia, where the young children go on pioneer camps to learn what it means to be a good Soviet.
I wish we could go to a place where we learn how to be a good human.
Oh.
That will be a start, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. So right.
Anyway, what is the one core value that shaped the character you are?
I think trying to be an individual, which again, I suppose, goes back to the twinness, but trying to be conscious of who I was and what I would have as an individual to offer the world, not as one of two, but as one of one.
Mm.
I think that was one of the things.
And I think that's what also makes people who work in diversity and inclusion so exceptional, because they really appreciate the individual. Mm-hmm. You understand that there are masses of people, but the uniqueness of everybody is what's most important.
I think you're spot on. I mean, I think one of the dangers of doing this kind of work is making the assumption that all black women are, that all white men are. I think, you know, you really need to have an interest in people as individuals and not just categories or stereotypes if you're really going to understand.
Hmm. Our conversation is making me reflect a lot already. But anyway, being a white female, how does the identity influence how you show up in the world?
I think being a white female in South Africa, or a white person in South Africa, comes, to be honest, with a lot of shame and a certain amount of guilt. It's not easy, you know, to pretend that we weren't all part of, privileged by, and let's be honest, Dudu, are still privileged by our whiteness in this country. We are, most definitely. I mean, it's evident if you go to rent a flat, if you and I both put on our jeans and went to rent a flat, I can tell you that I would be the one to have the first offer. Mm. If we were to arrive in a shop at the same time,
yeah,
I would be the one to be served first.
That I still experience.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I go to do work and I have to stay in a hotel with one of my colleagues who's black, when we approach reception, I'm the one.
That's
yes.
Interesting.
Of course, I get the bill as well, so it's not always good.
Assumptions.
Yes.
No, it's always funny when I go out with my white male friend. They don't know where, because I would have asked for the bill maybe, and then now they don't know where to put it.
I know exactly what you mean.
Anyway, oh, life is interesting. Do you believe you know the reason you were born, and how did you arrive at that knowledge and understanding?
You know, I don't believe I know the reason I was born. I mean, I was brought up as a Catholic, so I was brought up with a faith. And I suppose there were expectations along with that. But no, I have absolutely no idea. I just do have a strong belief that I have a responsibility to try and do good work, try and help people get to understand each other, try and help workplaces to become more unified, closer. But I don't believe that was my purpose in being born.
Mm. It will be interesting. It's always interesting when people know their purpose.
Yes,
that's why I'm
no
fascinated
idea.
With the question. So you're the managing director of Diversity, an HR and training company which specializes in change and transformation. And you have been in this field for a long time. Really,
yes.
Kudos to you, because we really understood this field because of you. How did you get into this area of work in the first place?
It was so interesting because I started off, I have a master's degree in psychology and I taught at Wits University for years. And while I was there, I was also not just teaching, but I was also the warden of their first mixed race, mixed gender residence called Barnato Hall.
Okay.
And this was in the early 80s, late-ish 80s. And it was fascinating because it was the first time the university had dared to mix young people across races and genders in one living space. And there was a lot of apprehension about what would happen and, you know, how they would get on. And being the warden of that residence taught me so much, Dudu. Mm. I first of all realized how little we knew about each other. I mean, most of the black students that came in, many of them were activists, saw the white students as terrorists or would be.
Yeah.
And some of them were not far wrong. And then for the white students, they saw the black students as terrorists, in fact. The black students saw the white students as boorah. And so there was
Everybody was a boorah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. There was this sense that the other was very different from me. The other was dangerous. The other was somebody I would never really get to know and be friends with. And I think that experience of people living together, and we did work then in a very, very unknown kind of way. I mean, we didn't really know how, to try and bring the students together, to help them understand each other.
Mm.
And the interesting thing was that one of our best teachers was the South African police. Because they would come into the residence, raid the residence, take away the black students, put them in prison.
Mm.
And that was such a wake-up call, because the white students knew these guys as colleagues, if not friends. And what's going on? And they're coming into my house at night with guns and dogs. And
so it's not imagined, because when people used to hear about these things. Yeah.
Exactly. They had this experience then of what was going on, and of course far worse was going on in townships.
Yeah.
But it was just a fascinating experience. And so I then decided to leave the university. I taught there for 12 years and to start a company doing this work. So I guess I was very much a pioneer in those days.
You were a pioneer,
and
yes.
It was completely a grudge purchase for companies. Because I started the company in 93, and then 94 came, and whoa, we were a rainbow. We were a wonderful country. Why do we need this work? Look at Mandela, he's so forgiving. And, you know, companies didn't want to come to terms with the fact that in their own environment, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all.
Yeah, because I know at Saatchi & Saatchi, we experienced your intervention in 96, 97, I think.
Must have been one of the first.
Yeah, one of the first. yes. Golly gumptious. Whoa, being a student those days, I don't know if I would have survived.
No, well, some of the students didn't survive, I mean, to be honest.
Because we were still like...
Yeah, and many of them were completely traumatised.
Can imagine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember having to phone mothers of students who'd been taken away in the middle of the night, and we didn't even know which prison they were in or where they were.
Wow.
So those times were challenging. Unfortunately, we've moved far from those kind of times.
And some of us didn't get to experience that, but, you know... What is distinctive about spirit of South Africans in a generalized way that you treasure and harness in the work that you do? Can you give an example in action?
Well, I suppose I would have said rugby, but I'm a bit nervous of saying that today since we didn't beat Ireland. But I think South Africans have a huge passion for their country, many of them, even if they disagree among themselves about how things should be done or what people should be doing. I think there's a huge passion about the country that drives people of all races and religions in South Africa. And I think that's what makes it such an incredibly appealing and attractive country, is the enthusiasm that people have for their country.
And it's great to work with people, because at least there's a starting point.
Absolutely.
When you have diversity workshops that they can all rally around. What is unconscious bias? Do you truly believe that most biases are unconscious? Or are we just whitewashing the cold, hard reality of pervasive and deliberate prejudicial behaviours?
I love that question, because you know what? I am very apprehensive about the term unconscious bias, especially as it applies in South Africa. Because we still have so much to learn about each other, I think a lot of our bias is very conscious. Extremely conscious. I mean, there may be occasions when people are biased without realizing why or where it's coming from, which would be unconscious. But I think for many of us with our history, our bias is pretty well conscious.
Yeah, that's my feeling. So I just wanted to find out from an expert, because I think we are really getting ourselves off the hook and we're not getting to do the real work. Buying just, unconscious bias. Yeah, no, you know what.
I agree with you.
We know what we're doing.
I really agree with you. And I think we need to get rid of that term. It doesn't apply in South Africa. I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in other countries. But I think with our history and still our present, most of our bias is conscious.
I think sometimes we adopt these terms because they make us feel better.
And also because they're cool and they're woke. And, you know, my company's doing unconscious bias training.
I mean, whatever.
And they don't know what that means.
What is a cultural competency? How is its presence evident in a workplace?
I think it's a very difficult thing. And it's, I mean, even though I've been doing this work for so many years, I still have to keep learning. I think it's learning about other people, whether other cultures, other races, other religions, and how to behave respectfully towards them within an organization.
Yeah.
So, for example, if the other is a Muslim woman, and I'm a man, I know that I shouldn't go and shake her hand because that wouldn't be acceptable to her as a woman to be touched by somebody.
Well, as me as a female, like Muslim guys, unless you're really a friend of mine, I don't go around hugging. Yes. I'm a hugger.
Yes, but not in that case.
Yeah.
And then I guess other things which sound so simple but make such a difference. I mean, greeting people. You know, greeting African people, black people.
God, when everybody does that, I'm like, what are you doing?
Yes. But even, you know, if I see you in the morning, I'm going to say, hello, how's it? If I see you again at tea time, how are you? And that's foreign to us in a way.
As why is
white
it?
Because we do greet people usually first if we see them in the morning.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't greet you every time we see you.
Because we are happy to see you. So we say, sayawana.
Yes.
So we're happy to see you.
And I guess the Sawbona has so much more depth than how's it or hello.
No.
Yes. But I think it's really consciously trying to learn about what might seem minor differences and understand how important they are in trying to build relationships with other people.
Yeah. Sometimes there are moments where I just am so grateful at the depth of African wisdom, you know, like the words are water. And now we just brush it off. We really don't understand. I'm seeing you, you know. And as me, as a human, seeing another human, it is such a spiritual experience, I think. Oh, well.
And seeing me and my ancestors and seeing me within my context.
Every context, Oh, boy. Elon Musk has said that DEI is just another word for racism. Shame on anyone who uses it. What is your view on his opinion?
I mustn't say anything too... I can't use any kind of language, but I think he obviously doesn't understand. First of all, DEI is an abbreviation for three different concepts: diversity, equity, and inclusion. And they're all very important, and they're all very different. So to dismiss it, the acronym, as once off and being racist, I mean, there's absolutely, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. I think his company could do with some DEI training, actually.
but I think the approach is, the minute you start caring for representation, then it means you are not focusing on white representation. Mm. I think that's part of the challenge, isn't it?
Mm.
That the minute you start saying to people, think of other races as well, think of other genders, think of other sexual orientations or religion, then it means that you're no longer looking at us.
Yes.
That becomes racist.
I guess that's where he's coming from, but I think that's, you know, that's very far from what is happening mostly. And I think that's one of the challenges in doing this work, is that it's not to teach white people about black people. It's to teach South Africans about each other and across all their differences.
Mm.
And sometimes that's, very often that's harder initially with white people who do feel a bit sometimes apprehensive about what, you know, where they're going to, what's going to be said about them, and if people talk about apartheid. And so there's a conscious nervousness very often at the beginning of this kind of work, until people begin to understand that it's about everybody.
Mm. In the 30 years of working in the diversity and inclusion field, can you articulate for us what is the most challenging prospect and fear of working in an environment that embraces diversity, which causes people to reject and sabotage transformation programs?
Mm. I think it's because sometimes people believe that it means that there's no place for them. Especially if you look at things like the Employment Equity Act, triple BEE, there's a lot of white fear around what that will mean. You hear things like, oh, there's no future for my child. You know, there's no future for me as a white man or a white person in this country. And I think that's where, you know, proper DEI is incredibly helpful, because it helps people to understand where their place is. There's a place for all of us. And our place is going to be so much better served by us if we understand one another,
yeah.
whether we're black or white or Indian or whatever. If we understand each other, then we're going to create a team of people who are confident and able to do the work that's required of them.
Yeah. And also that globally it's changing. I think it's also about the alignment of skills, that whether you're white, black, whatever color,
exactly,
you're not always going to get employment. It's just that I think people sometimes misuse the concept. And when somebody can't get a position, they say, oh, it's an AA candidate.
Yes, it's an AA candidate. And I think it's because employment equity has been, the equity part of DEI has been desperately misunderstood. People think that equity means equality, and it doesn't. I mean, as you know, Dudu, it's about making sure that people have a level playing field to start from, which in South Africa, unfortunately, is... Look at our levels of unemployment, for example.
Yeah, because even though I'm African privileged, I still have disadvantages because in a racial world, you're still the bottom of the pyramid.
Absolutely. And the pyramid is still in those layers.
Yeah.
With Africans at the bottom and us at the top.
Yeah. So what you're just saying now, I'm thinking of what Elon Musk said, which is DEI is just another word for racism. Shame on anyone who uses it. What is your view and his opinion?
My view on his opinion is that he needs some serious education on what DEI is all about.
Yeah.
First of all, it's not one thing. It's three very different things. Diversity is learning about difference. Equity is learning about equity, not equality. And inclusion is about creating an environment where people all feel they belong. So you can't just put them together. And all of them work very much towards anti-racism.
Yeah.
So I think he needs some education.
Maybe he doesn't know what racism is. I think people actually don't understand what racism is. Because when you start noticing and recognizing other races, does not nullify your own race. So, and that in itself is pointing out to the fact that maybe his perspective is a bit racist.
Well, he did. I better not say what I was going to say. I won't say that.
I was going to mention Pretoria Boys High, but I won't.
No, but he grew up in South Africa. And all of us who are white who grew up in South Africa can't have helped but absorb and imbue some kind of racism.
Yeah.
That's the environment that we grew up in.
Yeah.
We're not saying that it was our fault, but we can't deny that's the environment.
Yeah.
And that's where Elon Musk grew up.
Yeah. I think sometimes people forget that for you to have that life where there is a domestic worker looking after your home and your family, that they're not looking after their own, and that the salary that they're getting, they're not able to create the life that you are getting. So the whole thing is you're talking about equity. It's not necessarily talking about you're going to make it equal, but you're going to create some fair playing ground so that people could. And I think those are the nuances that it's unfortunate for somebody at his level has an opportunity to teach people that.
Absolutely, and has an opportunity. I mean, he's been had such a successful life in terms of money. Well, so it seems. Very different kind of life in terms of children and relationships. But, I mean, he could have had the most incredible opportunity to talk about how what South Africa did for him.
Hmm. Anyway, moving on, Elon. Can you share two tips about the art and science of having difficult conversations about discrimination in the workplace when you are feeling victimized?
I think the first thing about having any kind of conversation is being able to listen. You know, very often we're so desperate to get our point across or so desperate to say, but I didn't mean it. No, that wasn't what I meant at all, that we're not really listening. And I think that if we could genuinely listen to each other, we would learn a lot, and it would make for much more effective relationships between people.
Mm. listening is not a traumatic skill in many of us.
It's a, I think it's a very important skill, and I think, you know, we have a chance now, I think, to look at our school curriculum again with a new Minister of Education, and I think some of these things should be taught to children.
Mm. Yeah.
They should grow up understanding what it means.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Gosh. To be human, there are so many challenges. Equality and equity are proving to be elusive ideals globally. Why is that?
I think because in many countries, equity and equality seem to be the same thing. But in a country like South Africa, it's easier to understand them as being different because we see it, as you say, every day. I mean, you must have seen that classic cartoon of children trying to watch a sporting event, and one child is very short and one is medium and one is very tall. And then they put a box for the very short child to stand on, and he can now see as well. I mean, so it's about creating opportunities so that everyone starts at the same level.
Yeah, and they still see the same thing.
Yes, and they can all see the same thing and enjoy the same thing.
And the other two are not deprived. They also.
Exactly.
Wow, what an amazing case study. Woo. How can an organization calculate the return of their diversity programs? Can you give an example of a company where the ROI is objectively evident after the interventions?
You know, I think I can't, because with very few exceptions, and I don't want to name individual companies, South African companies don't take this work seriously. What they do is they say, oh, Terry, come in and you'll do a diversity workshop or you'll do a DEI workshop. And then we've done it.
Yeah.
They don't, first of all, give one the opportunity to really look at and understand the climate, because no two companies have the same issues. Mm-hmm. If Company A and Company B are both trying to transform, the issues that they're dealing with will be different.
Yeah.
So if you're coming in to help them, you need, first of all, to be given that opportunity.
Yeah, to understand that.
And then you need to design a program. You know, there's no one-size-fits-all in DEI. There really isn't, Dudu. And, you know, it's not an easy thing. You have to really understand the company, understand where their issues are. They might not be about race at all. They might be about gender.
Yeah.
They may be about ableism. Mm. I mean, religion, there are so many different things. Xenophobia is increasingly problematic. So I think it's about then designing something which speaks to that company and their particular issues. And then maybe you might do some workshops or some kind of sessions, but then you might need to do mentoring.
Yeah.
You're the expert here with their leadership. Mm. You might need to do managing diversity work with the managers.
Yes.
Because it's one thing to understand these concepts, but it's another to be able to manage people in a way that's sensitive.
Yeah.
So I think it's a much deeper and more profound issue. And I think all too often, companies imagine that if they've done one or two workshops, they've done the job.
Yeah.
And then they're surprised why they still have these issues and nothing's changed.
And sometimes it's not even... I was asked to come and do diversity and inclusion in a particular organization, a tech organization, and the issue was really the competence of the manager. Mm. It just so happened she was a white female, but that was not the issue. It was she was promoted into a level where she was not ready and she was immature. And everybody was focusing on her race. It was not her race. It was her competence. So you're right. The bespoke work, this is bespoke work. You need to be able to invest as a company to do the pre-work so that you understand what is going on. It is a pity.
And it needs, I think, a constant evaluation.
Yes.
You need to measure how well it's going. Maybe it's going well in these departments, not so well here. So let's have a closer look and see what's happening here. Mm. So it's, I think your use of the word bespoke is spot on, Dudu. It has to be bespoke if it's going to succeed.
Yeah, it's because people are trying to not have budget to do the pre-work.
Or the post-work, or the mentoring work. Mm. And I think that, evidence globally over many years shows that it definitely reaps rewards. And there are companies that have done this successfully and are doing well now.
Yeah. How do you respond to the comments that of black privilege in the context of BEE when people want to dismiss the idea of historical and systemic white privilege?
I think it's difficult sometimes for all of us to understand triple BEE. And I think it's a very, very important act. It hasn't been effectively implemented. But just because you have money and now you're living in a well-off suburb doesn't mean that you're not paying black tax to a million people in your family, that you're not still dealing with the issues that you've dealt with all your life, that you're still not looked down on by people that pretend to admire you. I mean, there are so many issues that I think black people have to deal with on a daily basis, which have nothing to do with money at all.
Yeah.
And yet we somehow would like to believe that, you know, if they're rich, then they're on the same.
Yeah,
that's the same. There's no problem.
I wasn't going to ask this, but now that you're talking about it, you have a mixed child. How does it make you feel? Has he experiences that made you feel like, oh my gosh, how am I going to protect him from this world?
Well, he's a grown man now, so
yeah.
But there have definitely been. I remember being asked when he was very small, about 2 or 3, isn't he cute? Where did you get him from? I didn't say my vagina, but that was the answer that was on the tip of my tongue. So I cut that.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, that was the one thing.
Gosh.
And then, I mean, he's obviously experienced racism all his life because he's black. He's always seen himself as black, even though he's biracial.
Yeah.
He's grown up feeling like a Xhosa man. I mean, he is a Xhosa man. That's who he is. But I think I experienced, if there's such a thing, a kind of secondhand racism through watching what he experienced very often.
Which even gives you more insights and credibility in the work that you do.
Except that I don't tell people necessarily.
No, but yes. I mean, I don't think you put it on your CV.
No.
But I'm just saying, as an individual
yes.
now,
yes.
I think that's what makes your insights the way they are.
Yes.
Because
I think it's been I feel enormously privileged to have my son.
Yeah.
I've learned so much from his father, from his family, from his grandmother, from his going to the mountain. I mean, from all the things he experienced growing up as a man, I felt privileged to be part of it as a mother.
I think it's a privilege just to understand another culture in general when you're not part of it. I
yes.
get very excited about that.
Yes.
Yeah. What is bystander racism?
That's when you see it's when you see racism happening, and you might be black or you might be white, but you see somebody saying something racist or behaving in a way that's racist.
Mm.
And though you're conscious of it, you see it happening, you don't do anything. You just stand by and let it.
Mm.
And I must say, it's very difficult to intervene sometimes. If you see somebody using racist language and you step forward, if I step forward and say, I'm sorry, but you can't call somebody that, you know, these words are now against the law, then what happens likely is the person turns around and will have a go at you. So it's when you allow things to happen, but you don't intervene.
Yeah.
Even though the intervention may be difficult to make.
It calls us all to be courageous, but sometimes
absolutely.
Courage can come with a personal cost.
No, it does. And you know, sometimes, you know, I can think about my own life. There have been times when I should have been far more courageous than I was. You know, we'd like to feel that, you know, we've always done it right. Mm. But even I, who work in this field, I make mistakes all the time. I'm learning all the time. You know, these things happen. So one can never feel that one's an expert or got all the answers or anything like that.
Yeah, because it's also a new generation now and they have...
Absolutely. But, you know, interesting you should say that because... you know, I keep hearing often in my work, oh, well, of course, it's, you know, these young people, you know, they don't have these problems.
No.
But of course they do.
It's different.
Yes, but they just experience them differently.
Different categories that you discriminate against now.
Yes.
What is your view of people who use the difficult socioeconomic challenges, inequality, poverty, that the leakage and corruption of an African-led government has caused in South Africa to say that white privilege is not a factor in the status and conditions of black people any longer?
Well, I think they're just totally misled, Dudu. I mean, I think that people always assume that a government making mistakes is because they're black.
Yeah.
So a corrupt government is a black government.
We expected that from a black government.
Yes, of course. And there's a shrug that goes with it and a knowing look. But gradually, I think South Africa's becoming more aware, more conscious, you know, elbowing the unconscious side of it away and being more aware of things as they really are.
Mm.
But I think one has to try so hard as a black person in a white organization to really be seen for the talent that one has and the expertise that one has.
Even as a business person, believe me.
Yes. No, I mean as a business person.
Boy,
and I mean as a woman as well. It's doubly hard.
Mm, yeah. Okay. What keeps you awake at night as a South African, if anything at all?
Oh, yes.
and that is not a joke.
Well, yes.
Yes.
No, I mean, I think often worrying about where the next cent is going to come from, worrying about why doesn't this organization take this seriously? Why don't they allow us to dig deeply into what's going on here? So those kind of things work-wise.
Yeah.
And then other things would be things to do with the country. You know, how on earth is this coalition government going to turn out? You know, will Gayton McKenzie be able to make a good job of culture and sport and everything? Mm-hmm. And will Minister X be able to... You know, that sort of thing obviously keeps me awake, like all of us as South Africans.
That they do a good job.
Yes. I mean. Yeah. Will they put us first? Will they really have our interests at heart? Or will they have their own interests at heart? And with all that, then we'll go corruption and so on. Mm-hmm. And then another thing is, how are we going to deal with people that we know or we assume are corrupt from the trials they've been involved in? But how can we just leave these things? Mm. I think as South Africans, we need to be far more vigorous in acting and responding.
We let things go.
We do.
If it's no longer front page news, it's like, boy. What is the one decision you wish you had never made in life and why?
Do you know, I can't think of one, Dudu, to be honest. I'm sure, I mean, that's not to say I haven't made many mistakes.
Yeah.
I have made many mistakes. Staying in a relationship too long, hanging in there too long.
My mother wishes I could stay in a relationship too long or be in one at all.
Yes.
Yes.
But, you know, hanging in when clearly
there's
no point in it. I think that would be one thing.
Yeah.
And then never having written my book, or having written it but not having published
it. Please do. I just hope by the time we have this in the public that it's on the shelf somewhere.
Yes. You know, so I guess one always wishes there were things one had done. So it's not so much, I mean, I own up to my mistakes. I own up to the things I've done wrong. And there may be many of them, there probably are. But I think it's more about the I wish I'd things. I wish I'd done this or... You know, I wish I'd done that.
There is nobody that needs to publish more than you. You need to have that book out. I'll be waiting. What book would you recommend to this audience and why?
The New Apartheid by Sizwe Mpofu Walsh.
Uh-huh.
And that's because it looks at where we are now, but from so many different points of view. from a legal point of view, from a education point of view, from a finance point of view, from a healthcare point of view, and helps us to understand that apartheid hasn't died. It's just changed the way it operates. For most people.
Yeah. That will be a nice one to read when people do their pastel analyses in terms of our strategy, which most of the time we actually don't do that. We don't do much research. We just focus on what's going on in our organization. That's a good one.
And then, I mean, I read a lot. Yeah. I mean, I like various authors. I love Joyce Carol Oates. I tend to like women authors for some reason.
I
don't know why.
Yeah.
Not romance and things, but I like books that deal with life and its difficulties, really.
Okay. Thank you for that. So, we could talk forever. I really have enjoyed this one. Any final wisdom that you would like to share with us?
I think, you know, that DEI begins with everybody as an individual. You know, if you're a white person watching this, how well do you know that woman that helps in your house? Do you know her last name? Can you say it? Do you know where she lives? Have you taken her home? Do you know her children? And if you're a black person, don't just assume that because she's white, she's well off and she's got all the... She's privileged because of her skin tone, but there may be many other hardships she's going through. So I think it's about really trying to understand people as individuals for who they are and the contribution they can make to South Africa.
Yeah, totally buy into that. It is always sad that we always assume. Oh, the one that also doesn't roll down well is the assumed white competence.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I see it all the time. That, I mean, if two people go in for job interviews and they ask me to come and sit in and give advice on the white person, especially if they're a man, is assumed to have the competence. A woman, even if she's white, not so much, but a black person has to prove.
Yeah.
And when they, if they get the job, that you know, the difficulty working in the spotlight all the time, proving your competence, it's exhausting.
Telling me, oh, I've aged just during this conversation when I think what my life is about. But like, we can only get better.
We can try,
yeah.
And we are trying.
Yeah. There we are, folks. Hope you have enjoyed this wisdom as I have. Until next time, on another Wisdom Personified Conversations with Dudum Zomi. Thank you for listening to this episode of Wisdom Personified Conversations with Dudum Zomi. Please also like, follow, and subscribe to our channel and share the wisdom with your friends. I would love it if you could rate and review as well. Wisdom Personified Conversations with Dudum Zomi is also available on YouTube, Facebook Watch, Apple, and Google Podcasts, as well as Spotify. Enjoy the wisdom journey.